and welcome to another episode of Such Stuff, the podcast from Shakespeare's Globe. Whilst we're working hard to bring you content and stories to keep you inspired whilst our building is closed, there are still so many extraordinary events and performances that we were so sad to have to postpone or cancel. One that we were gutted to miss out on was a special event we had planned with the brilliant author Maggie O'Farrell. The author of 8 novels plus the Sunday Times number 1 best-selling memoir I Am, I Am, I Am, she has been nominated for the Costa Novel Award 3 times and won it for The Hand That First Held Mine. Her new book, Hamnet, is set in the summer of 1596, and it imagines the story behind one of Shakespeare's best-known tragedies and its connection to Shakespeare's only son, Hamnet. It's a stunning novel, a tender story of love and grief that shifts the focus to the family that Shakespeare left behind in Stratford when he moved to London to become the playwright we know today. We cannot recommend the novel enough, and if that's not high enough praise, it's just been nominated for the Women's Prize for Fiction. We were so looking forward to hosting Maggie at the Globe, but through the wonders of technology, I still managed to catch up with her for a chat about the book. As her first historical novel, I asked how she researched the story, how she approached the daunting prospect of writing about such a well-known figure as Shakespeare, and we were lucky enough to have Maggie read an extract from the novel. So, without further ado, Maggie O'Farrell. The book very much focuses on Agnes and the family in Stratford. Why did you choose to focus the story on them and to tell it through their eyes?
Well, I think I have always been really interested, particularly in Hamnet. You know, I first heard about him when I was studying the play for my Scottish Highers when I was 16. And the play just really got under my skin. I think as it maybe does with a certain type of adolescent. That's a kind of slightly gloomy adolescent, which I certainly was. And I think it just really spoke to me, really got under my skin, and I really sort of identified with Hamlet, the character. And then one day my teacher mentioned in passing that Shakespeare had a son who was called Hamnet, and he had died a couple of years before the play was written. And, you know, I mean, it's strange, you know, because later in life, you know, I studied literature at university, and obviously then I was reading a lot of critics and a lot of biographers and on Shakespeare. And I was always really shocked that even in these kind of huge 500-page biographies that you get, Hamnet, the boy, got very little mention. You know, he maybe gets 2 references, if he's lucky. So you get, you know, you get a mention of his birth and you get a mention of his death, and that's about it. And his death was always followed by several paragraphs about Elizabethan child mortality, almost as if the implication was that it wasn't really that upsetting because it happened so much and they would have been half expecting it. And, you know, even though I was, whatever I was, 18 or 19 at this point, and I was really far off being a parent, certainly very far off being a writer, really kind of struck me. I thought, what a terrible presumption to make. The idea that he and Hamlet's mother and his sisters didn't grieve for him is seemed to me an outrageous assumption. You know, when I wanted to write the book, I wanted to give this boy, who I think has been really overlooked by history, a voice and a presence, you know, because it's not nothing to call perhaps your greatest tragedy and your most enduring anti-hero after your dead son. You know, it's speaking enormous volumes. And of course, Shakespeare is a man who's very, you know, for all his incredible output that we still have, thanks to his 2 friends, he is quite a mysterious figure. You know, we do know very little about him, really. Very little, very few concrete facts. But this act in calling this play after your dead son seems to me to speak, and it's a huge communication to us as an audience and as readers. And it, you know, speaks of such enormous depth of grief and the desire to still be communicating with this dead boy.
Mm. There's this very, very rich texture to the daily life that you build in Stratford, and the medicinal elements of Agnes's work and the landscape. How did that come to play such a big role in the novel, and how did that picture build for you? Was there a lot of research involved?
The thing about Shakespeare is you could spend the rest of your life reading about him. You know, there's the amount that's written about him is astonishing. And, you know, plenty of people do spend their lives reading about him. So, I mean, in a sense, I tried to balance it. You know, I really wanted to... I suppose my impulse with the book was to communicate that although, obviously, a lot of this scholarly work, and quite rightly so, focuses on Shakespeare's career in London, it seems to me that the biggest sort of drama of his life was happening off stage, and it happened in Stratford off stage with his family, and that's the death of his son. And so I suppose I wanted to kind of animate the people who are necessarily sort of sidelined in his story, and in particular with his wife, who we know, you know, usually is Anne Hathaway. But one of the other things that struck me when I was you know, beginning the research for the book, because it's a book I wanted to write for a long time, is that how much, you know, obviously there are such huge longueurs and voids in William's story, but I mean, we think we don't know much about him, we know even less about her. You know, we don't even have the record of her birth, for example, because I think she was born before parish records were taken. It just struck me, I was really horrified actually, because what seems to have happened in her case is that people have rushed forward to fill the voids in her story with this, you know, terrible negativity and criticism. You know, she's attracted so much hostility and opprobrium and disapproval, and all this, you know, people have judged her so harshly. It's jaw-dropping, you know. I mean, if you ask, I don't know, a passerby in the street, say, what do you know about the woman Shakespeare married? They're probably likely to say he hated her and that she trapped him into marriage, that she was an older, that she was scheming, that she was this kind of peasant, you know. And it's really shocking. I was so shocked by this because, and you find it everywhere on all kind of levels, you know, right down to scholarly work, up to popular culture. I felt so offended on her behalf that I wanted to try and create a kind of three-dimensional character for her. I wanted her to be a fully realised person with a life and a kind of creativity of her own, in a sense, and artistry. There is no evidence, actually, that he hated her at all. And I think, you know, there is evidence, I think, that they had a proper partnership and maybe they were in love. I hope they were. I mean, certainly at the end of his life, when he retired from the stage, you know, he was an incredibly wealthy man at this point. You know, not only was he an incredibly successful writer, as we know, an actor, but he was a very canny businessman. You know, he'd invested a huge amount of money in property, but he still lived in quite modest lodgings in London. But all his money he sent back to Stratford, you know, and he bought his wife and daughters after Hamlet died this enormous house. I mean, it's vast, which doesn't seem to me the kind of act of somebody who hated his family or his wife and regretted his marriage. And, you know, he also, at the end of his life, when he retired, he came back to Stratford. He chose to live there with her and didn't stay in London. So it seems to me those are huge signifiers of love. But also, I suppose with the character, you know, one of the things that really shocked me, actually, when I was researching it, was coming across her father's will. So Richard Hathaway, he died a year before they married, and he left her a very generous dowry. But he describes her in his will as my daughter Agnes, which in Elizabethan times would have been pronounced Annis or Agnes, like the French. But I was so shocked when I read that, because I thought, you know, if anyone's going to know her proper name, her given name, it's going to be her dad, isn't it? And I thought, my God, have we been calling her by the wrong name for 400 years? How is that possible? And if we've called her by the wrong name, you know, maybe we've been wrong about everything. Maybe, in a sense, it was a kind of gift to a novelist, because I sort of seized on this name and I thought, this is an opportunity to ask people to think again, to forget everything they think they know about her and open themselves up to a new interpretation. You know, I was very keen to give her a kind of artistry and a sense of creativity of her own. And it's always fascinated me, and I'm sure many other people, about Shakespeare's plays, is the kind of reach and the breadth of his metaphors. You know, he draws on such incredible knowledge on a huge range of things. And I find in Hamlet, obviously, there are many, many references to plants and their kind of medicinal properties, and very knowledgeable ones as well. He clearly knew what he was talking about. And they're also, you know, running through his work, he often reaches for falconry or hawking metaphors a lot. So that really intrigued me as well. And so I decided to give these two things to her. I like the idea of this partnership and him drawing knowledge and some of his metaphors from her sort of skills. So yeah, I gave them to her. Those two things actually were the most fun I had with the book, because, you know, so obviously I did a lot of library-based research, but then in order to kind of inhabit Agnes properly, I actually went and learned to fly a kestrel. Yeah, it was fantastic. And I also dug and planted an Elizabethan herb garden. I'm not a gardener at all, but I wanted to kind of understand the sort of the labour involved in that task, you know, because it's one thing to kind of read, I don't know, they use rue to protect themselves from infection, but I actually wanted to physically plant rue and nurture it, and then I went on a course to learn how you make, you know, because, you know, you have this plant and you think, well, what do I do with it? Do I use the seeds? Do I use the flowers, the stems, the roots, you know, the one? And it's all, you know, everything is very, very different, and I learned how to do that. So I do actually still in my cupboard still have jars of elderberry syrup and elixirs, and I occasionally try to give them to my children, but they very firmly refuse.
Sort of like method writing,
I guess. So, but I think it was just that I wanted to, you know, because obviously it's the first, I mean, when I say it's the first historical book I've written, I did write one that was set in the 20s, but, you know, that's almost within living memory. You know, I can ask people who were alive then if I have questions. But this was so long ago. Their lives were so different to ours in so many ways. And, you know, it was incredibly, you know, it's not easy for me to imagine what it would have been like to have been a woman in those days when in a household that you're running, every single thing that people use or ate or sat upon or, you know, had to be made by you or provided by you. And I think about Shakespeare's mother, Mary Arden. I mean, that's a number of children she had, you know. And when William was 18 and getting married, she still had two-year-old Edmund, this toddler, running around. And just the idea, I mean, just the very sort of idea of having to feed and clothe that number of children every day without washing machines and without cookers. it's staggering to us. It's so alien to us now what their daily life would have been. I wanted to kind of get as close to it as I possibly could.
And we've spoken a lot about where Anne's character came from. Obviously, we have centuries of ideas about who Shakespeare was. And the character that you've written is, you know, he feels like a very human person, not like a caricature of all the Shakespeares we know. How did you sort of get to your Shakespeare and strip away all of those other versions of him?
Well, I think that was the most nerve-wracking thing, obviously, of the whole book, because he's an intimidating person to write about. And obviously he carries, just his very name carries so much heft, you know, because every single person, I think, has their own relationship with him inside their head, because he pervades our very language, you know, the very language that we use. And, you know, he defined and set how we think about ourselves and changed how we think about ourselves and continues to do so, of course, with every kind of production we see. So, yeah, it was no small task. But I think I was very keen. In the whole of the book, I never mention his name. He's never named. I don't even mention the name Shakespeare, but I don't even call him William or Will, because, you know, even if you write that, it seems so colossally presumptuous. Who do I think I am? So I was keen to kind of divide the character from the name in a way, because he isn't, as you say, he isn't the main character in the book. You know, I really wanted the book to focus on the boy, Hamnet, and his mother and his sisters, the kind of untold story. But also, I suppose what interested me, you know, that when the book opens, he is 18, so he isn't the playwright yet. You know, he hasn't yet sort of found himself in that way. And obviously there are so many theories about how this grammar school boy from Stratford, from this quite small rural market town, became, you know, the world's greatest ever writer, not even in his time, but, you know, ever since then, nobody's even come close to him. I mean, it is astonishing when you think about it. You know, you think about Marlowe or Johnson, you know, his contemporaries, both of whom went to university, and it's possible, you know, that Shakespeare didn't have any education beyond the age of 15. I was just trying to imagine what he would have been like, you know, what other inhabitants of Stratford or rural Warwickshire would have thought of him, because even then he must have been extraordinary. You know, he must have stuck out like a sore thumb. People must have not known what to make of him at all. I mean, imagine being his teacher at grammar school. Imagine what it was like teaching him Latin or Greek or, you know, rhetoric. I mean, the speed at which his brain must have worked must have been like nothing else. So I suppose I was trying to just imagine this youth. I mean, it's interesting to imagine him at 18. And also the idea as to why Hathaway would have married him, you know, because she was 26 and she was of quite marriageable age. She came from a very respectable family, whereas, as you know, the course of Shakespeare's fortunes had taken a bit of a nosedive. I knew almost from the beginning that I would never be able to use his name. So in the book, he's referred to as the son or the husband or the Latin tutor at one point. I mean, it's partly because, you know, it's actually impossible. I found it impossible to sit down at my laptop and write a sentence, you know, like, I don't know, William Shakespeare came and had porridge for breakfast. I mean, you know, instantly, as soon as you write that, you get pulled out and you think, I'm an absolute Egypt. Why am I even attempting this? I suppose it's that kind of process of defamiliarising. You know, I wanted to defamiliarise myself to him and think of him as a person, as a bloke, you know. And I suppose I'm asking readers to do that as well. On a morning in early spring, a Latin tutor is standing at the window in Hewland's farm, absently tugging on the hoop through his left ear. He is watching the trees. The boys are behind him. They are conjugating verbs,
temporarily unheard by the tutor, who was intent on the startling contrast between the sharply blue spring sky and the new leaf green of the forest. The colours seemed to fight, vying for supremacy, vibrancy, the green versus the blue, one against the other. The children's Latin verbs wash over him, through him, like the wind through the trees. He is just about to turn and face his pupils when he sees from the trees a figure emerge. For a moment, the tutor believes it to be a young man. He is wearing a cap, a leather jerkin, gauntlets. He moves out of the trees with a brand of masculine entitlement, covering the ground with booted strides. There is some kind of bird on his outstretched fist, chestnut brown with a creamy chest, its wings spotted with black. It sits hunched, subdued, its body swaying with the movement of its companion, its familiar. The tutor is imagining this person, this hawk-taming youth, to be some kind of factotum to the farm, or a relative to the family, a visiting cousin, perhaps. Then he registers the long plait hanging over the shoulder, reaching past the waist, the jerkin laced tight around a form that curves suspiciously inwards at the middle. He sees the skirts, which had been bunched up, now hastily being dragged down around the stockings. He sees a pale oval face under the cap, an arched brow. He moves closer to the glass, leaning on the sill, and watches as the woman moves from the left to the right of the window frame, her bird riding on her fist, her skirt swishing around her boots. Then she enters the farmyards, moves through the chickens and geese, around the side of the house, and is gone. He straightens, his frown vanished, a smile forming under his scant beard. Behind him, the room has fallen silent. He recalls himself, the lesson, the boys, the verb conjugation. He turns. He arches his fingers together, as he imagines a tutor ought to do, as his own masters at school did not so long ago. "Excellent," he says to them. They look towards him, plants turning towards the sun. He smiles at their soft, unformed faces, pale as unrisen dough in the light from the window. He pretends not to see that the younger brother is being poked under the table with a peeled stick, and that the elder has filled his slate with a pattern of repleted loops. "Now," he says, "I would like you to work on the translation of the following sentence. I thank you, sir, for your kind letter." They begin to labour over their slates, the elder, and stupidest, the tutor knows, breathing through his mouth, the younger laying down his head on his arm. And really, what sense is there in giving these boys lessons? Aren't they destined to become sheep farmers like their father and older brothers? But then, what use has it been to him? Years and years at the grammar school, and look where it has got him. A smoke-hazed hall, coaxing the sons of a sheep farmer to learn conjugation and word order. He waits until the boys have finished this exercise before he says, "What is the name of that serving girl? The one with the bird."
So one of the things I really loved about the book is the alternating chapters. So you have the twin children, Hamnet and Judith, who get sick, and then the alternate chapters sort of fill in the whole backstory. And it really made me think, and I don't know if this is just because of the time in which I'm reading it, but it really made me think about the way that illness plays with time, and you get this sort of suspended feeling of all time and no time. And I wondered if that was something you were thinking about at all when you were writing the book.
Well, certainly I always thought that, you know, when you do have a severe illness, it is, like you say, it's an experience out of time. You know, when you're in a kind of sick room or when you're unwell, everything is quite unreal and also quite heightened. When I wrote the book, you know, however it was, how long ago it was, 3 years ago or so, you know, the idea of this kind of looming pandemic, you know, it was very alien to me. I had to kind of, it was more a kind of case of research or imagination or something, you know, because I think we're so used to the idea that we kind of assume that we're inviolate now. You know, we have this incredible medications and we have these hospitals, and it's hard in a sense for us to imagine what it must have been like then. You know, that there was this ever-present threat of what we now call the Black Death, you know, what they call the pestilence, which, you know, would sweep through towns and cities. And I mean, it killed think it was a third of the population of London, you know, in the middle of the 17th century, which is unthinkable, you know, but also that's only one of many, many things that could have killed you, you know, diphtheria or measles or flu or diarrhea. I mean, anything, you could cut your finger and you'd be dead within 2 days of sepsis if you were unlucky. So I think illness was properly terrifying to them, and rightly so. In the middle of the book, it kind of opens out and the camera kind of pulls back from Stratford, and I sort of describe the journey of the plague, how the plague arrives in Warwickshire, and I trace this journey of an infected flea from Alexandria on a ship. And obviously when I wrote that, I had all these maps of Elizabethan trade routes, and I was working out where the ship would have stopped off and what it would have picked up silks here and picked up cloves and spices there, and it would have come all the way around Africa and up. And it is really odd. Looking at me, and I'm looking at them now, actually, in my study, they're still there, and they look oddly like the infographics that we are all studying right now, you know, every morning. So it is really odd, and it's certainly not something I ever foresaw happening. But I do think the Black Death is very active still in our imaginations, and I think we kind of reach for the metaphors and the lessons learned from that, those particular horrible pandemics, in our thinking about contagion and illness now. It is very strange for us. Obviously, it's a very, very strange experience that we're all going through. But I think to the Elizabethans, it was something, unfortunately, that they were all too used to. The idea that they, you know, I mean, the first thing the authorities in London would do in a plague outbreak was to shut all the playhouses because, you know, obviously all those people gathering in the middle of the day in the sun was, you know, it was a very quick way of spreading infection. So I think Shakespeare's career would have been constantly disrupted by plague outbreaks and probably other outbreaks as well. You know, there's lots of documentary evidence that the playhouses were closed, that the Globe was closed, and he often went on tour around Shropshire and Kent. And he was actually in Kent on tour when Hamnet died. There is evidence of that, unfortunately, and it's not even known whether he made a funeral, which is so heartbreaking to think of that. Or I suppose he would have gone home to Stratford and maybe done some writing or bought some more fields. Who knows what he was up to? I've always wondered, actually, whether the people of Stratford at that time thought of him as a landowner and a businessman or whether they thought of him as a playwright. I suspect the former. I do wonder how much Stratford knew about him, about what he was up to, and I have a feeling they didn't really know what he was doing. They just thought he was a businessman.
Speaking of London, the book, without giving anything away, I hope, you do eventually see Shakespeare in London. Why is it that you sort of saved that to the end, and how did you sort of bring those scenes together, and how did you balance, because it struck me as really interesting how you write prose in a novel about a play.
Well, I always knew that the book would end in London and at the Globe. I always knew that, and that was where it was headed, because I think the question for me was how might his family have felt when they discovered that he'd written this play. It isn't a question I've ever seen addressed anywhere else, I don't think. And I was thinking, well, how would I have felt as a mother if my husband took the name of our dead son and wrote a play about it, you know? And I was looking at the playbill of Hamlet, and I was thinking, well, how would I have felt? And did he tell her? At what point did he tell her? And when did she find out? And would she have been curious? Would she have seen? And of course, we don't actually know whether Agnes or Anne or Susanna and Judith ever saw any of his plays. We don't know. I really hope they did. But it just seemed to me that the novel had to end there with the play in the Globe. There's certainly anecdotal mention that Shakespeare played the ghost in the first productions of Hamlet. I don't know if that's true. It may be apocryphal, but I mean, it sort of seems to fit, actually, I think, in terms of, I think, what he's doing now with the play. Because obviously I read the play again quite carefully when I was writing the novel. And it's interesting because I have such an overhang of impression about it from my adolescence and from when I was a student. And it's very interesting reading it now as, what, you know, a kind of 40-something parent. There's a huge amount of debate in sort of scholarly circles about how old Hamlet is supposed to be. You know, what age is he? And it's funny, reading it now, I looked at it and I thought, God, he's 15. You know, he's a 15 or 16-year-old adolescent, this poor child, really. I mean, sort of man-child who is dragged far too soon into this very difficult and traumatic adult world, you know, and there's murder and the death of his father and his mother's remarriage and, you know, allegations of incest, and he's pulled too young into this very sort of traumatic adult issues. He just struck me very, very much as that. And I thought, well, you know, if we are to believe that Shakespeare wrote it in 1600, then Hamnet would have been 15. And just it's just such a heartbreaking idea that he was sort of reanimating his dead son and reimagining him. And also the idea that the ghost is also Hamnet. So the identity of his son is split into this father-son unit, and the son is alive and the father is dead. And oh God, it's just, if you read it through those spectacles, in a sense, through the spectacles of Hamnet's death, it's just heartbreaking. It's almost unbearable. I mean, it's as heartbreaking, actually, as the number of times that Shakespeare imagines boy and girl twins who are separated and then magically reunited. Those are unbearable to read, those scenes, when you think about poor Judith and Hamnet.
It's interesting what you say about very closely reading Hamlet. As a writer writing about another writer, did you feel sort of a tussle at all? Particularly because we know Shakespeare's words so well and they're so quoted. The book has such a clarity and singularity of voice. Was that a difficult thing to sort of negotiate how your voice related to Shakespeare's at all?
Yeah, I mean, the first absolutely inviolable rule there was that I was never, ever going to attend kind of God, Elizabethan Shakespeare and dialogue. I have a very good friend who's quite forthright, and she said, when I told her what I was writing, she said, whatever you do, you're not allowed to use the word prithee. And I said, I promise I will never use it. I mean, that's the kind of, oh, the historical novel that would just give me the absolute shivering horrors. So no, I knew that I was never going to do it. And also, it's not as if anyone could ever attempt to emulate his writing. So it was just never going to happen. And also, in a sense, it was, the book was not focusing on him as a writer. It's focusing on him as a man, actually, I suppose, more than anything. I didn't want to kind of, I mean, in a sense, you can't really trespass on his writing. It would be very, very wrong in so many different ways. So I didn't even attempt that. I didn't even come close to it. I didn't try to come close to it. I mean, there are, I hope, actually, very subtle hints at certain images or certain sort of tropes that you find in his writing. I've always been quite interested in where certain sort of characters come from. Not only is there a kind of hint when he first sees Agnes in the book, he thinks she's a man, and then he realises she's a woman because she's been out hawking, and so she's wearing a sort of masculine outfit. And of course, you know, if anyone's seen any Shakespeare plays, that sort of gender switch is very, very common. And also, even the idea that women were played by young boys in Elizabethan times is quite intriguing. I was wondering where the kind of very despotic, angry, quite violent men, sort of power-crazed and sort of disappointed men, is the sort of Corioliuses of the world come from. And so I used that sort of character type for the father in the book. And I should actually apologise to the real John Shakespeare, because it's quite possible he was a very lovely man and he and William got on really well, who knows. But in my book, you know, he is a kind of very angry, disappointed man, because obviously his career has taken a huge nosedive. He's very angry with William because he wants William to get a job and, you know, and to kind of make something of himself. So there is that. And also the kind of idea of Agnes being a sort of healer, I find that intriguing, and the boy and girl twins. And I hope it isn't a kind of those things that aren't sort of clunkily weighted in the novel, because again, you know, you can't touch Shakespeare. You've got to be very, very careful around him, because not only because everybody knows so much about him, but also he's sort of sacrosanct in a way. You know, you have to be very respectful of that.
That's it from us, but we'll be back soon with more stories from Shakespeare's Globe. Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell is available now in hardback from online bookshops and downloadable as an ebook and audiobook. You've been listening to Such Stuff with me, Imogen Greenberg, and Maggie O'Farrell. To find out more about Shakespeare's Globe, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'll be back soon with more stories from Shakespeare's Globe, so subscribe wherever you get this podcast from.